He had 3.5 hours to wait, and it was going to seem a lot longer. It proved to be the longest wait of his life before he finally met Paige as arranged. The first thing Paige said was, "You're out of your mind. Why in hell did you come back?" "I'm not back for long." Tautly, Anderton prowled around the monkey block, systematically locking one door after another. "Don't let anybody in. I can't take chances."
"You should have quit while you were ahead."
In an agony of apprehension, Paige followed after him. "Whitwer is making hay hand over fist. He's got the whole country screaming for your blood." Ignoring him, Anderton snapped open the main control bank of the analytical machinery. Which of the three monkeys gave the minority report?
"Don't question me, I'm getting out."
On his way to the door, Paige halted briefly, pointed to the middle figure, and then disappeared. The door closed. Anderton was alone. The middle one. He knew that one well. The dwarfed, hunched-over figure had sat buried in its wiring and relays for 15 years. As Anderton approached, it didn't look up. With eyes glazed and blank, it contemplated a world that did not yet exist, blind to the physical reality that lay around it. Jerry was 24 years old. Originally, he had been classified as a hydrocephalic idiot, but when he reached the age of 6, the psych testers had identified the precog talent, buried under the layers of tissue corrosion. Placed in a government-operated training school, the latent talent had been cultivated. By the time he was 9, the talent had advanced to a useful stage. Jerry, however, remained in the aimless chaos of idiocy. The burgeoning faculty had absorbed the totality of his personality. Squatting down, Anderton began disassembling the protective shields that guarded the tape reels stored in the analytical machinery. Using schematics, he traced the leads back from the final stages of the integrated computers to the point where Jerry's individual equipment branched off. Within minutes, he was shakily lifting out 2 half-hour tapes, recent rejected data not fused with majority reports. Consulting the code chart, he selected the section of tape which referred to his particular card. A tape scanner was mounted nearby. Holding his breath, he inserted the tape, activated the transport, and listened. It only took a second. From the first statement of the report, it was clear what had happened. He had what he wanted. He could stop looking. Jerry's vision was misphased. Because of the erratic nature of precognition, he was examining a time area slightly different from that of his companions. For him, the report that Anderton would commit a murder was an event to be integrated along with everything else. That assertion, and Anderton's reaction, was one more piece of datum. Obviously, Jerry's report superseded the majority report. Having been informed that he would commit a murder, Anderton would change his mind and not do so. The preview of the murder had canceled out the murder. Prophylaxis had occurred simply in his being informed. Already a new time path had been created, but Jerry was outvoted. Trembling, Anderton rewound the tape and clicked on the recording head. At high speed, he made a copy of the report, restored the original, and removed the duplicate from the transport. Here was the proof that the card was invalid, obsolete. All he had to do was show it to Whitwer. His old stupidity amazed him. Undoubtedly, Whitwer had seen the report, and in spite of it, had assumed the job of commissioner, had kept the police teams out. Whitwer didn't intend to back down. He wasn't concerned with Anderton's innocence. What then could he do? Who else would be interested?
"You damn fool,"
a voice behind him grated, wild with anxiety. Quickly he turned. His wife stood at one of the doors in her police uniform, her eyes frantic with dismay. "Don't worry," he told her briefly, displaying the reel of tape. "I'm leaving." Her face distorted, Lisa rushed frantically up to him.
"Paige said that you were here, but I couldn't believe it. He shouldn't have let you in. He just doesn't understand what you are."
"What am I?" Anderton inquired caustically. "Before you answer, maybe you better listen to this tape."
"I don't want to listen to it. I just want you to get out of here. Ed Whitwer knows somebody's down here. Paige is trying to keep him occupied, but..."
She broke off, her head turned stiffly to one side.
"He's here now. He's going to force his way in."
"Haven't you got any influence? Be gracious and charming. He'll probably forget about me." Lisa looked at him in bitter reproach.
"There's a ship parked on the roof. if you want to get away."
Her voice choked, and for an instant she was silent. Then she said,
"I'll be taking off in a minute or so. If you want to come..."
"I'll come," Anderton said. He had no other choice. He'd secured his tape, his proof, but he hadn't worked out any method of leaving. Gladly, he hurried after the slim figure of his wife as she strode from the block through a side door and down a supply corridor, her heels clicking loudly in the deserted gloom.
"It's a good fast ship," she told him over her shoulder. "It's emergency fueled, ready to go. I was going to supervise some of the teams."
Behind the wheel of the high-velocity police cruiser, Anderton outlined what the Minardi report tape contained. Lisa listened without comment, her face pinched and strained, her hands clasped tensely in her lap. Below the ship, the war-ravaged rural countryside spread out like a relief map, the vacant regions between cities crater-pitted and dotted with the ruins of farms and small industrial plants.
"I wonder," she said, when he had finished, "how many times this has happened before?"
"A minority report? A great many times."
"I mean one precog misphased, using the report of the others as data, superseding them."
Her eyes dark and serious, she added,
"Perhaps a lot of the people in the camps are like you."
"No," Anderton insisted, but he was beginning to feel uneasy about it, too. "I was in a position to see the card, to get a look at the report. That's what I did."
"But,"
Lisa gestured significantly,
"perhaps all of them would have reacted that way. We could have told them the truth."
"It would have been too great a risk," he answered stubbornly. Lisa laughed sharply.
"Risk? Chance? Uncertainty? With precogs around?"
Anderton concentrated on steering the fast little ship. "This is a unique case," he repeated, "and we have an immediate problem. We can tackle the theoretical aspects later on. I have to get this tape to the proper people before your bright young friend demolishes it."
"You're taking it to Kaplan?"
"I certainly am." He tapped the reel of tape which lay in the seat between them. "He'll be interested. Proof that his life isn't in danger ought to be a vital concern to him." From her purse, Lisa shakily got out her cigarette case.
"And you think he'll help you?"
"He may or he may not. It's a chance worth taking."
"How did you manage to go underground so quickly?" Lisa asked. "A completely effective disguise is difficult to obtain."
"All it takes is money," he answered evasively. As she smoked, Lisa pondered.
"Probably Kaplan will protect you," she said. "He's quite powerful."
"I thought he was only a retired general."
"Technically, that's what he is. But Whitwer got out a dossier on him. Kaplan heads an unusual kind of exclusive veterans organization. It's actually a kind of club with a few restricted members. High officers only, an international class from both sides of the war. Here in New York, they maintain a great mansion of a house, 3 glossy paper publications, and occasional TV coverage that costs them a small fortune."
"What are you trying to say?"
"Only this. You've convinced me that you're innocent. I mean, it's obvious that you won't commit a murder. But you must realize now that the original report, the majority report, was not a fake. Nobody falsified it. Ed Whitwer didn't create it. There's no plot against you, and there never was. If you're going to accept this minority report as genuine, you'll have to accept the majority one also."
Reluctantly, he agreed. "I suppose so."
"Ed Whitwer," Lisa continued, "is acting in complete good faith. He really believes you're a potential criminal. And why not? He's got the majority report sitting on his desk, but you have the card folded up in your pocket."
"I destroyed it," Anderton said quietly.
Lisa leaned earnestly toward him. "Ed Whitwer isn't motivated by any desire to get your job," she said. "He's motivated by the same desire that's always dominated you. He believes in pre-crime. He wants the system to continue. I've talked to him, and I'm convinced he's telling the truth."
Anderton asked, "Do you want me to take this reel to Whitwer?" "If I do, he'll destroy it."
"Nonsense," Lisa retorted. "The originals have been in his hands from the start. He could have destroyed them any time he wished."
"That's true," Anderton conceded.
"Quite possibly he didn't know." "Of course he didn't. Look at it this way. If Kaplan gets hold of that tape, the police will be discredited. Can't you see why? It would prove that the majority report was an error. Ed Whitwer is absolutely right. You have to be taken in if pre-crime is to survive. You're thinking of your own safety, but think for a moment about the system."
Leaning over, she stubbed out her cigarette and fumbled in her purse for another.
Which means more to you, your own personal safety or the existence of the system?
My safety, Anderton answered without hesitation.
You're positive?
If the system can survive only by imprisoning innocent people, then it deserves to be destroyed. My personal safety is important because I'm a human being. And furthermore,
from her purse, Lisa got out an incredibly tiny pistol.
I believe, she told him huskily, that I have my finger on the firing release. I've never used a weapon like this before, but I'm willing to try.
After a pause, Anderton asked, You want me to turn the ship around? Is that it?
Yes. Back to the police building. I'm sorry. If you could put the good of the system above your own selfish...
Keep your sermon, Anderton told her. I'll take the ship back, but I'm not going to listen to your defense of a code of behavior no intelligent man could subscribe to.
Lisa's lips pressed into a thin, bloodless line. Holding the pistol tightly, she sat facing him, her eyes fixed intently on him as he swung the ship in a broad arc. A few loose articles rattled from the glove compartment as the little craft turned on a radical slant, one wing rising majestically until it pointed straight up. Both Anderton and his wife were supported by the constraining metal arms of their seats, but not so the third member of the party.
Out of the corner of his eye, Anderton saw a flash of motion. A sound came simultaneously, the clawing struggle of a large man as he abruptly lost his footing and plunged into the reinforced wall of the ship. What followed happened quickly. Fleming scrambled instantly to his feet, lurching and wary, one arm lashing out for the woman's pistol. Anderton was too startled to cry out. Lisa turned, saw the man, and screamed. Fleming knocked the gun from her hand, sending it clattering to the floor. Grunting, Fleming shoved her aside and retrieved the gun.
Sorry, he gasped, straightening up as best he could. I thought you might talk more. That's why I waited.
You were here when... Anderton began and stopped. It was obvious that Fleming and his men had kept him under surveillance. The existence of Lisa's ship had been duly noted and factored in. And while Lisa had debated whether it would be wise to fly him to safety, Fleming had crept into the storage compartment of the ship.
Perhaps, Fleming said, you better give me that reel of tape.
His moist, clumsy fingers groped for it.
You're right. Whitwer would have melted it down to a puddle.
Kaplan, too? Anderton asked numbly, still dazed by the appearance of the man.
Kaplan's working directly with Whitwer. That's why his name showed up on line 5 of the card. Which one of them is the actual boss, we can't tell. Possibly neither.
Fleming tossed the tiny pistol away and got out his own heavy-duty military weapon.
You pulled a real flub in taking off with this woman. I told you she was back of the whole thing.
I can't believe that, Anderton protested.
If she... You got no sense. This ship was warmed up by Whitwer's order. They wanted to fly you out of the building so that we couldn't get to you. With you and your own, separated from us, you didn't stand a chance.
A strange look passed over Lisa's stricken features.
It's not true, she whispered. Whitwer never saw this ship. I was going to supervise...
You almost got away with it,
Fleming interrupted inexorably.
We'll be lucky if a police patrol ship isn't hanging on us. There wasn't time to check.
He squatted down as he spoke, directly behind the woman's chair.
The first thing is to get this woman out of the way. We'll have to drag you completely out of this area. Page tipped off Whitwer on your new disguise, and you can be sure it's been widely broadcast.
Still crouching, Fleming seized hold of Lisa. Tossing his heavy gun to Anderton, he expertly tilted her chin up till her temple was shoved back against the seat. Lisa clawed frantically at him. A thin, terrified wail rose in her throat. Ignoring her, Fleming closed his great hands around her neck and began relentlessly to squeeze.
No bullet wound, he exclaimed, gasping. She's gonna fall out. Natural accident. It happens all the time. But in this case, her neck will be broken first.
It seemed strange that Anderton waited so long. As it was, Fleming's thick fingers were cruelly embedded in the woman's pale flesh before he lifted the butt of the heavy-duty pistol and brought it down on the back of Fleming's skull. The monstrous hands relaxed. Staggered, Fleming's head fell forward and he sagged against the wall of the ship. Trying feebly to collect himself, he began dragging his body upward. Anderton hit him again, this time above the left eye. He fell back and lay still. Struggling to breathe, Lisa remained for a moment huddled over, her body swaying back and forth. Then gradually, the color crept back into her face. "Can you take the controls?" Anderton asked, shaking her, his voice urgent.
"Yes, I think so."
Almost mechanically, she reached for the wheel.
I'll be all right. Don't worry about me.
"This pistol," Anderton said, "is Army Ordnance issue. But it's not from the war. It's one of the useful new ones they developed. I could be a long way off, but there's just the chance." He climbed back to where Fleming lay spread out on the deck. Trying not to touch the man's head, he tore open his coat and rummaged in his pockets. A moment later, Fleming's sweat-sodden wallet rested in his hands. Todd Fleming, according to his identification, was an Army major attached to the Internal Intelligence Department of Military Information. Among the various papers was a document signed by General Leopold Kaplan stating that Fleming was under the special protection of his own group, the International Veterans League. Fleming and his men were operating under Kaplan's orders. The bread truck, the accident, had been deliberately rigged. It meant that Kaplan had deliberately kept him out of police hands. The plan went back to the original contact in his home when Kaplan's men had picked him up as he was packing. Incredulous, he realized what had happened. Even then, they were making sure they got him before the police. From the start, it had been an elaborate strategy to make certain that Whitwer would fail to arrest him. "You were telling the truth," Anderton said to his wife as he climbed back in the seat. "Can we get hold of Whitwer?" Mutely, she nodded. Indicating the communications circuit of the dashboard, she asked, "What did you find?" "Get Whitwer for me. I want to talk to him as soon as I can. It's very urgent." Jerkily, she dialed, got the closed-channel mechanical circuit, and raised police headquarters in New York. A visual panorama of petty police officials flashed by before a tiny replica of Ed Whitwer's features appeared on the screen. "Remember me?" Anderton asked him. Whitwer blanched. "Good God! What happened? Lisa, are you bringing him in?" Abruptly, his eyes fastened on the gun in Anderton's hand. "Look," he said savagely, "don't do anything to her. Whatever you think, she's not responsible." "I've already found that out," Anderton answered. "Can you get a fix on us? We may need protection getting back."
"Back?"
Whitwer gazed at him unbelievingly.
"You're coming in? You're giving yourself up?"
"I am, yes." Speaking rapidly, urgently, Anderton added, "There's something you must do immediately. Close off the monkey block. Make certain nobody gets in, Page or anyone else, especially Army people."
"Kaplan,"
the miniature image said. "What about him?"
"He was just here. He just left."
Anderton's heart stopped beating. "What was he doing?"
"Picking up data, transcribing duplicates of our precog reports on you. He insisted he wanted them solely for his protection."
"Then he's already got it," Anderton said. "It's too late." Alarmed, Whitwer almost shouted,
"Just what do you mean? What's happening?"
"I'll tell you," Anderton said heavily, "when I get back to my office." Whitwer met him on the roof of the police building. As the small ship came to rest, a cloud of escort ships dipped their fins and sped off. Anderton immediately approached the blonde-haired young man. "You've got what you wanted," he told him. "You can lock me up and send me to the detention camp, but that won't be enough." Whitwer's blue eyes were pale with uncertainty.
"I am afraid I don't understand."
"It's not my fault. I should have never left the police building. Where's Wally Page?"
"We've already clamped down on him," Whitwer replied. "He won't give us any trouble."
Anderton's face was grim. "You're holding him for the wrong reason," he said. "Letting me into the monkey block was no crime, but passing information to Army is. You've had an Army plant working here," he corrected himself, a little lamely. "I mean, I have.
I called back the order on you. Now the teams are looking for Kaplan."
"Any luck?"
"He left here in an Army truck. We followed him, but the truck got into a militarized barracks. Now they've got a big wartime R-3 tank blocking the street. It would be civil war to move it aside."
Slowly, hesitantly, Lisa made her way from the ship. She was still pale and shaken, and on her throat an ugly bruise was forming.
"What happened to you?" Whitwer demanded.
Then he caught sight of Fleming's inert form lying spread out inside. Facing Anderton squarely, he said,
Then you finally stopped pretending this is some conspiracy of mine.
I have.
You don't think I'm, he made a disgusted face, plotting to get your job?
Sure you are. Everybody's guilty of that sort of thing, and I'm plotting to keep it. But this is something else, and you're not responsible.
Why do you assert, Whitwer inquired, that it's too late to turn yourself in? My God, we'll put you in the camp. The week will pass and Kaplan will still be alive.
He'll be alive, yes, Anderton conceded. But he can prove he'd be just as alive if I were walking the streets. He has the information that proves the majority report obsolete. He can break the pre-crime system.
He finished.
Heads or tails, he wins, and we lose.
The army discredits us. Their strategy paid off.
But why are they risking so much? What exactly do they want?
After the Anglo-Chinese War, the army lost out. It isn't what it was in the good old AFWA days. They ran the complete show, both military and domestic, and they did their own police work.
Like Fleming, Lisa said faintly.
After the war, the West Bloc was demilitarized. Officers like Kaplan were retired and discarded.
Nobody likes that, Anderton grimaced.
I can sympathize with him. He's not the only one. But we couldn't keep on running things that way. We had to divide up the authority.
You say Kaplan has won, Whitwer said. Isn't there anything we can do?
I'm not going to kill him. We know it, and he knows it. Probably he'll come around and offer us some kind of deal. We'll continue to function, but the Senate will abolish our real pull. You wouldn't like that, would you?
I should say not, Whitwer answered emphatically. One of these days I'm going to be running this agency.
He flushed.
Not immediately, of course.
Anderton's expression was somber. It's too bad you publicized the majority report. If you had kept it quiet, we could cautiously draw it back in. But everybody's heard about it. We can't retract it now.
I guess not, Whitwer admitted awkwardly. Maybe I don't have this job down as neatly as I had imagined.
You will in time. You'll be a good police officer. You believe in the status quo, but learn to take it easy. Anderton moved away from them. I'm going to study the data tapes of the majority report. I want to find out exactly how I was supposed to kill Kaplan. Reflectively, he finished. It might give me some ideas.
The data tapes of the precogs, Donna and Mike, were separately stored. Choosing the machinery responsible for the analysis of Donna, he opened the protective shield and laid out the contents. As before, the code informed him which reels were relevant, and in a moment he had the tape transport mechanism in operation. It was approximately what he had suspected. This was the material utilized by Jerry, the superseded time path. In it, Kaplan's military intelligence agents kidnapped Anderton as he drove home from work. Taken to Kaplan's villa, the organization GHQ of the International Veterans League, Anderton was given an ultimatum. Voluntarily disband the pre-crime system or face open hostilities with the army. In this discarded time path, Anderton, as police commissioner, had turned to the Senate for support. No support was forthcoming. To avoid civil war, the Senate had ratified the dismemberment of the police system and decreed a return to military law to cope with the emergency. Taking a corps of fanatic police, Anderton had located Kaplan and shot him, along with other officials of the Veterans League. Only Kaplan had died. The others had been patched up, and the coup had been successful. This was Donna. He rewound the tape and turned to the material previewed by Mike. It would be identical. Both precogs had combined to present a unified picture. Mike began as Donna had begun. Anderton had become aware of Kaplan's plot against the police. But something was wrong. Puzzled, he ran the tape back to the beginning. Incomprehensibly, it didn't jibe. Again, he replayed the tape, listening intently. The Mike report was quite different from the Donna report. An hour later, he had finished his examination, put away the tapes, and left the monkey block. As soon as he emerged, Whitwer asked, "What's the matter? I can see something's wrong."
"No," Anderton answered slowly, still deep in thought. "Not exactly wrong."
A sound came to his ears. He walked vaguely over to the window and peered out. The street was crammed with people. Moving down the center lane was a four-column line of uniformed troops. Rifles, helmets,
marching soldiers in their dingy wartime uniforms, carrying the cherished pennants of AFWA, flapping in the cold afternoon wind.
"An army rally," Whitwer explained bleakly. "I was wrong. They're not going to make a deal with us. Why should they? Kaplan's going to make it public."
Anderton felt no surprise. "He's going to read the minority report?"
"Apparently.
They're going to demand the Senate disband us and take away our authority. They're going to claim we've been arresting innocent men, nocturnal police raids, that sort of thing. Rule by terror."
"You suppose the Senate will yield?"
Whitwer hesitated.
"I wouldn't want to guess."
"I'll guess," Anderton said. "They will. That business out there fits with what I learned downstairs. We've got ourselves boxed in, and there's only one direction we can go. Whether we like it or not, we have to take it."
His eyes had a steely glint.
Apprehensively, Whitwer asked, "What is it?"
"Once I say it, you'll wonder why you didn't invent it. Very obviously, I'm going to have to fulfill a publicized report. I'm going to have to kill Kaplan. That's the only way we can keep them from discrediting us."
"But," Whitwer said, astonished, "the majority report has been superseded."
"I can do it," Anderton informed him, "but it's going to cost. You're familiar with the statutes governing first-degree murder?"
"Life imprisonment."
"At least. Probably you could pull a few wires and get it commuted to exile. I could be sent to one of the colony planets. The good old frontier.
Would you prefer that?"
"Hell no," Anderton said heartily. "But it would be the lesser of the two evils. And it's got to be done."
"I don't see how you can kill Kaplan."
Anderton got out the heavy-duty military weapon Fleming had tossed to him. "I'll use this."
"They won't stop you?"
"Why should they? They've got that minority report that says I've changed my mind."
"Then the minority report is incorrect."
"No," Anderton said. "It's absolutely correct. But I'm going to murder Kaplan anyhow."
He had never killed a man. He had never even seen a man killed. And he had been police commissioner for 30 years. For this generation, deliberate murder had died out. It simply didn't happen. A police car carried him to within a block of the army rally. There in the shadows of the back seat, he painstakingly examined the pistol Fleming had provided him. It seemed to be intact. Actually, there was no doubt of the outcome. He was absolutely certain of what would happen within the next half hour. Putting the pistol back together, he opened the door of the parked car and stepped warily out. Nobody paid the slightest attention to him. Surging masses of people pushed eagerly forward, trying to get within hearing distance of the rally. Army uniforms predominated, and at the perimeter of the cleared area, a line of tanks and major weapons was displayed. Formidable armaments still in production. Army had erected a metal speaker stand and ascending steps. Behind the stand hung the vast AFWA banner, emblem of the combined powers that had fought the war. By a curious corrosion of time, the AFWA Veterans League included officers from the wartime enemy. But a general was a general, and fine distinctions had faded over the years. Occupying the first rows of seats sat the high brass of the AFWA command. Behind them came junior commissioned officers. Regimental banners swirled in a variety of colors and symbols. In fact, the occasion had taken on the aspect of a festive pageant. On the raised stand itself sat stern-faced dignitaries of the Veterans League, all of them tense with expectancy. At the extreme edges, almost unnoticed, waited a few police units, ostensibly to keep order. Actually, they were informants making observations. If order were kept, the army would maintain it. The late afternoon wind carried the muffled booming of many people packed tightly together. As Anderton made his way through the dense mob, he was engulfed by the solid presence of humanity. An eager sense of anticipation held everybody rigid. The crowd seemed to sense that something spectacular was on the way. With difficulty, Anderton forced his way past the rows of seats and over to the tight knot of army officials at the edge of the platform. Kaplan was among them. But he was now General Kaplan. The vest, the gold pocket watch, the cane, the conservative business suit, all were gone. For this event, Kaplan had got his old uniform from its mothballs. Straight and impressive, he stood surrounded by what had been his general staff. He wore his service bars, his medals, his boots, his decorative short sword, and his visored cap. It was amazing how transformed a bald man became under the stark potency of an officer's peaked and visored cap. Noticing Anderton, General Kaplan broke away from the group and strode to where the younger man was standing. The expression on his thin, mobile countenance showed how incredulously glad he was to see the commissioner of police.
"This is a surprise," he informed Anderton, holding out his small, great, gloved hand. "It was my impression you had been taken in by the acting commissioner."
"I'm still out," Anderton answered shortly, shaking hands. "After all, Whitwer has that same reel of tape." He indicated the package Kaplan clutched in his steely fingers and met the man's gaze confidently. In spite of his nervousness, General Kaplan was in good humor.
"This is a great occasion for the Army," he revealed. "You'll be glad to hear I'm going to give the public a full account of the spurious charge brought against you."
"Fine," Anderton answered noncommittedly.
"It will be made clear that you were unjustly accused."
General Kaplan was trying to discover what Anderton knew.
"Did Fleming have an opportunity to acquaint you with the situation?"
"To some degree," Anderton replied. "You're going to read only the minority report? That's all you've got there?"
"I'm going to compare it to the majority report."
General Kaplan signaled an aide, and a leather briefcase was produced.
"Everything is here. All the evidence we need," he said. "You don't mind being an example, do you? Your case symbolizes the unjust arrests of countless individuals."
Stiffly, General Kaplan examined his wristwatch.
"I must begin. Will you join me on the platform?"
"Why?" Coldly, but with a kind of repressed vehemence, General Kaplan said,
"So they can see the living proof. You and I together, the killer and his victim, standing side by side, exposing the whole sinister fraud which the police have been operating."
"Gladly," Anderton agreed. "What are we waiting for?" Disconcerted, General Kaplan moved toward the platform. Again, he glanced uneasily at Anderton, as if visibly wondering why he had appeared and what he really knew. His uncertainty grew as Anderton willingly mounted the steps of the platform and found himself a seat directly beside the speaker's podium.
"You fully comprehend what I'm going to be saying?" General Kaplan demanded. "The exposure will have considerable repercussions. It may cause the Senate to reconsider the basic validity of the pre-crime system."
"I understand," Anderton answered, arms folded. "Let's go." A hush had descended over the crowd, but there was a restless, eager stirring when General Kaplan obtained the briefcase and began arranging his material in front of him.
"The man sitting at my side," he began in a clean, clipped voice, "is familiar to you all. You may be surprised to see him, for until recently he was described by the police as a dangerous killer."
The eyes of the crowd focused on Anderton. Avidly, they peered at the only potential killer they had ever been privileged to see at close range.
"Within the last few hours, however," General Kaplan continued, "the police order for his arrest has been canceled. Because former Commissioner Anderton voluntarily gave himself up? No, that is not strictly accurate. He is sitting here. He has not given himself up, but the police are no longer interested in him. John Allison Anderton is innocent of any crime in the past, present, and future. The allegations against him were patent frauds, diabolical distortions of a contaminated penal system based on a false premise. A vast impersonal engine of destruction grinding men and women to their doom."
Fascinated, the crowd glanced from Kaplan to Anderton. Everyone was familiar with the basic situation.
"Many men have been seized and imprisoned under the so-called prophylactic pre-crime structure," General Kaplan continued, his voice gaining feeling and strength. "Accused not of crimes they have committed, but of crimes they will commit. It is asserted that these men, if allowed to remain free, will at some future time commit felonies. But there can be no valid knowledge about the future. As soon as precognitive information is obtained, it cancels itself out. The assertion that this man will commit a future crime is paradoxical. The very act of possessing this data renders it spurious.
In every case, without exception, the report of the three police precogs has invalidated their own data. If no arrests had been made, there would still have been no crimes committed.
Anderton listened idly, only half hearing the words. The crowd, however, listened with great interest. General Kaplan was now gathering up a summary made from the minority report. He explained what it was and how it had come into existence. From his coat pocket, Anderton slipped out his gun and held it in his lap. Already, Kaplan was laying aside the minority report, the precognitive material obtained from Jerry. His lean, bony fingers groped for the summary of first Donna, and after that, Mike.
"This was the original minority report," he explained. "The assertion, made by the first two precogs, that Anderton would commit a murder. Now here is the automatically invalidated material. I shall read it to you."
He whipped out his rimless glasses, fitted them to his nose, and started slowly to read. A queer expression appeared on his face. He halted, stammered, and abruptly broke off. The papers fluttered from his hands. Like a cornered animal, he spun, crouched, and dashed from the speaker's stand. For an instant, his distorted face flashed past Anderton. On his feet now, Anderton raised the gun, stepped quickly forward, and fired. Tangled up in the rows of feet projecting from the chairs that filled the platform, Kaplan gave a single, shrill shriek of agony and fright. Like a ruined bird, he tumbled, fluttering and flailing from the platform to the ground below. Anderton stepped to the railing, but it was already over. Kaplan, as the majority report had asserted, was dead. His thin chest was a smoking cavity of darkness, crumbling ash that broke loose as the body lay twitching. Sickened, Anderton turned away and moved quickly between the rising figures of stunned army officers. The gun, which he still held, guaranteed that he would not be interfered with. He leaped from the platform and edged into the chaotic mass of people at its base. Stricken, horrified, they struggled to see what had happened. The incident, occurring before their very eyes, was incomprehensible. It would take time for acceptance to replace blind terror. At the periphery of the crowd, Anderton was seized by the waiting police. "You're lucky to get out," one of them whispered to him as the car crept cautiously ahead. "I guess I am," Anderton replied remotely. He settled back and tried to compose himself. He was trembling and dizzy. Abruptly, he leaned forward and was violently sick. "The poor devil," one of the cops murmured sympathetically. Through the swirls of misery and nausea, Anderton was unable to tell whether the cop was referring to Kaplan or to himself. Four burly policemen assisted Lisa and John Anderton in the packing and loading of their possessions. In 50 years, the ex-commissioner of police had accumulated a vast collection of material goods. Somber and pensive, he stood watching the procession of crates on their way back to the waiting trucks. By truck, they would go directly to the field, and from there to Centaurus 10 by inter-system transport. A long trip for an old man. But he wouldn't have to make it back. "There goes the second from last crate," Lisa declared, absorbed and preoccupied by the task. In sweater and slacks, she roamed through the barren rooms, checking on last-minute details. "I suppose we won't be able to use these neutronic appliances. They're still using electricity on Centen." "I hope you don't care too much," Anderton said. "We'll get used to it," Lisa replied and gave him a fleeting smile. "Won't we?"
"I hope so. You're positive you'll have no regrets?"
"If I thought..."
"No regrets," Lisa assured him. "Now, suppose you help me with this crate." As they boarded the lead truck, Whitworth drove up in a patrol car. He leaped out and hurried up to them, his face looking strangely haggard.
"Before you take off," he said to Anderton, "you'll have to give me a breakdown on the situation with the precogs. I'm getting inquiries from the Senate. They want to find out if the middle report, the retraction, was an error or what."
Confusedly, he finished,
"I still can't explain it. The minority report was wrong, wasn't it?"
"Which minority report?" Anderton inquired, amused. Whitwer blinked.
"Then that is it. I might have known."
Seated in the cabin of the truck, Anderton got out his pipe and shook tobacco into it. With Lisa's lighter, he ignited the tobacco and began operations. Lisa had gone back to the house, wanting to be sure nothing vital had been overlooked. There were three minority reports, he told Whitwer, enjoying the young man's confusion. Someday, Whitwer would learn not to wade into situations he didn't fully understand. Satisfaction was Anderton's final emotion. Old and worn out as he was, he had been the only one to grasp the real nature of the problem. The three reports were consecutive, he explained. The first was Donna. In that time path, Kaplan told me of the plot, and I promptly murdered him. Jerry, phased slightly ahead of Donna, used her report as data. He factored in my knowledge of the report. In that, the second time path, all I wanted to do was to keep my job. It wasn't Kaplan I wanted to kill. It was my own position and life I was interested in. And Mike was the third report? That came after the minority report? Whitwer corrected himself. I mean, it came last? Mike was the last of the three, yes. Faced with the knowledge of the first report, I decided not to kill Kaplan. That produced report two. But faced with that report, I changed my mind back. Report two, situation two, was the situation Kaplan wanted to create. It was to the advantage of the police to recreate position one. And by that time, I was thinking of the police. I had figured out what Kaplan was doing. The third report invalidated the second one in the same way the second one invalidated the first. That brought us back to where we started from. Lisa came over, breathless and gasping.
Let's go. We're all finished here.
Lithe and agile, she ascended the metal rungs of the truck and squeezed in beside her husband and the driver. The latter obediently started up the truck, and the others followed. Each report was different, Anderton concluded. Each was unique. But two of them agreed on one point. If left free, I would kill Kaplan. That created the illusion of a majority report. Actually, that's all it was. An illusion. Donna and Mike previewed the same event, but in two totally different time paths, occurring under totally different situations. Donna and Jerry, the so-called minority report and half of the majority report, were incorrect. Of the three, Mike was correct, since no report came after his to invalidate him. That sums it up. Anxiously, Whitwer trotted along beside the truck, his smooth blonde face creased with worry. Will it happen again? Should we overhaul the setup? It can happen in only one circumstance, Anderton said. My case was unique since I had access to the data. It could happen again, but only to the next police commissioner. So, watch your step. Briefly, he grinned, deriving no inconsiderable comfort from Whitwer's strained expression. Beside him, Lisa's red lips twitched, and her hand reached out and closed over his. Better keep your eyes open, he informed young Whitwer. It might happen to you, at any time.